You'll have the pleasure of listening to Fred Wade, who has been in charge of this program, and he may talk a little longer than he expected.
Thank you very much, Connie. I am alias Bullet Wurtz tonight, I think. John Nichols is our principal speaker. He was double booked tonight. I've been assured that he will only be 10 minutes or so late. But some of you may have seen that there's a film at the Barrymore tonight and last night called The Coen Brothers Exposed. And it was advertised as having John Nichols and Lisa Graves on both nights. So they felt that they had to at least welcome people there very briefly and then come over here. So we have a few minutes before the main program will start. I apologize for any inconvenience that may have caused for some of you. This is the spring forum of the Madison Institute. For those of you that are familiar with our organization, we try to have a forum featuring a major speaker and a response panel at least twice a year. In the past, we've had a number of distinguished speakers, including most recently William Grider, Dean Baker, Jeremy Suri, who unfortunately left this university to go to Texas recently, Naomi Klein, Joshua Farley, John Dean, Stanley Cutler, and all the way back to in earlier years, Gaylord Nelson, and our inaugural speaker was John Kenneth Galbraith back in 1985. We are a 501c3 organization, so we can't endorse or oppose candidates or legislation directly. But we can discuss important issues of the day, and we do, and we certainly at this point in time are at a critical juncture in our history, both as a state and as a nation. So we thought that this program, featuring John Nichols, who recently wrote a book about the uprising of 2011, and we have some copies on sale. If you would like to purchase a copy, perhaps John could sign it at the end of the program. We thought it was timely, and it would be informative to give some further light on the topics at issue here. I should give a disclaimer. We often do not provide a disclaimer, but the views expressed then, our function is to provide a forum. It's not to endorse or oppose anything specifically. So that the views that you hear are those of the speakers we present, do not necessarily represent the views of the organization as an entity, or the views of any member of the board of directors, although I will distinguish. A couple of minutes to the steps for that if necessary. These programs cost money, as you may imagine. On the way in, you may have seen you may have been handed an envelope such as this. There are also some blue baskets on the way out. We would appreciate your support so that we can continue to bring these types of programs to you. The programs are always free and open to the public. And our only source of support is the donations that those of you who are interested and appreciate the work that we do are willing to provide. I'll hold the introductions for a moment. So we stand at a historic crossroads at this point in time. But it's not entirely unprecedented. Back in the time of the fall of 1904, between 1896 and 1904, we were also very much divided, as we are now. The polls say we were divided about 48-48, with about 4% in the middle. Back then, we were also very bitterly divided as a state. I came across recently, Alfred O. Barton was a mass journalist who covered La Follette. And and wrote about it, wrote a memoir called The La Paz Winning of Wisconsin. He speaks of the time of the 1904 election. 1904, that was the year that there was a famous convention, Republican State Convention, at the Red Gym over here on the campus, where they got the football players and the barbed wire to guide the delegates in so that they couldn't be stormed by people who did not have delegate credentials. And they got the football players and other large and burly people to guard the premises to make sure that there was no violence. And there were predictions or fears of real violence at that convention, about just a couple of blocks away. And during the campaign, Bart wrote, houses were divided against one another. Father was set against son, brother against brother, and even sister against sister. Business partnerships were disrupted. Children of opposing factions occasionally were not permitted to play with them together. The parents of one side regarding the children of the other as something almost unclean. He says it may sound incredulous and ridiculous to us in the 1920s when he wrote that, yet it is literally true that in many places practically every question with reference to men and policies was considered in the light of its connection to La Paz. And there is another way in which this is not unprecedented. La Paz, when he was 18, in the summer of 1873, came to Madison to inquire about attending the University of Wisconsin as an undergraduate. While he was here on that exploratory trip, he happened to go to the state capitol and observe the law school graduation ceremony for the class of 1873. The speaker that day was Edward Ryan, who was not yet a member of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. He was about to be appointed. He had a long, distinguished career as a Democrat and a lawyer in Milwaukee. He recently served as Milwaukee City Attorney. And he gave a speech in which he raised the question, which in some ways is the same question that we face today, and the same question that LaPaul dealt with when he got into politics and ran for governor, later served as governor of this state and in the United States Senate. Said, the question will arise, and arise in your day, which shall rule? Wealth or man? Which shall lead? Money or intellect? Who shall fill public stations? Educated and patriotic free men, or the feudal serfs of corporate capital? LaPaul recognized, as I think we often forget in our time, that our most fundamental right is the right of the people to make their own laws. When he was summing up the results of the progressive movement, when he was running for president in October of 1912, said the essence of the progressive movement was not any particular issue or piece of legislation or program. Said it lies in its purpose to uphold the fundamental principles of representative government. It expresses that the hopes and desires of common men and women who are willing to fight for their ideals, to take defeat if necessary, and still go on fighting. And that was always his perspective. In his frame of reference, he saw corporations and special interests, particularly railroad interests, the lumber barons, the Milwaukee Street Railroad and utility interests, as destroying every resemblance of representative government in this state, through the influence that they were able to exercise over politics. And he said, in the introduction to his autobiography, We are often slow to realize that democracy is a life, that it involves continual struggle, that it is only as those of every generation who left democracy resist with all their might the encroachments of its enemies that the ideals of representative government can even nearly be approximated. As we cannot rest comfortably on the assumption that because our form of government is democratic, that it will automatically provide democratic results. And he spoke, for example, from experience. Just a couple of examples. In 1896, he ran for governor. At that time, selections were made. There were district caucuses and conventions. They would elect delegates to go to a state convention. And they would select a nominee for a state, various state offices. Just wind this up real quick. And the night of the first day of the convention, they did not finish the nominations. Overnight, around midnight, people started coming to his room at the hotel, in the hotel in Milwaukee, and said, "You know, I was offered a bribe." And a number of people came. They were arranged up amount from $2,500 to $700 to switch your vote. And he was denied the nomination. Later in 1900, he was elected. The opposition faded away. He thought, Von Bell wrote in her biography of Bob, that the road seemed smooth and clear ahead. And he was inaugurated, they had their program. They were going to get enacted. The conservative faction announced they had votes in the state senate that blocked his program, and they entirely blocked his program. He got nothing done in his first term. He became very sick, deathly ill for about a year, almost died. He came back to run again, and in 1904 there was a decisive election, and he won, and that was the first real success Democratic of the progressive movement. Lincoln Steffens came to town in 1904, and originally it was suggested he should expose McCall as a charlatan. Instead, he wrote an article in McClure's magazine and said, "This McCall is the real deal. He restored representative government in Wisconsin." And with that introduction, yeah. John Nichols with us tonight as our principal speaker. The associate, as many of you know, probably don't have to say this, but he's the associate editor of the Capital Times, writes for The Nation, Progressive Magazine. He is the author of, I understand, 7 books. I only have 4 listed. The Genius of Impeachment, Death and Life of American Journalism, The S Word, and most recently, The Uprising, which is available out here. So with that, I'll save the introduction to Pamela until later. I give you the indefatigable, the prolific, and insightful John Nichols. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much to Fred Wade for, you know, I knew that I should delay. I actually just waited out in my car because I knew how desperately Fred Wade would want to tell you just a few tidbits from ancient Wisconsin history. Fred is my hero. He is an absolute hero to me because I love the history of Wisconsin. I love its story. I love the evolution of this state. And Fred Wade has made it, you know, just a minor, I don't know if it's a deity, sort of a religious construction, but he has gone into the structural realities of how we ended up with the most powerful veto in America, and the, which sounds, you know, who cares about vetoes, right? Except for Frank. But this is the bottom line. This is the transfer of power from the legislative branch to the executive branch, and the concentration of power in individuals in a circumstance where our politics is now defined so much at a presidential gubernatorial level, where big money flows in, that these individuals who are now so empowered have the ability to define the whole of our governance. And so what Fred Wade talks about, is democracy itself and the fundamental threat to it. And there is no one, no one in this state who has fought harder to undo that damage. And he is an absolute hero of mine, Mr. Fred Wade. Now, I am also very honored to be here with Mary Bell, who is, you know, president, who is under demand to be at 1,000 different places at any given moment, and has a little bit of, you know, there's a little bit of fight going on right now. They just took away, they're structurally taking away as much as 30% of teachers' pay. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely, it is outrageous. And again, being done not through the legislative process, not being done by any vote of the people, being done by one man, Scott Walker, putting in an administrative rule change, putting in people that can make that change. That is the moment that we are in. And I suspect Mary might even tell you a little about that tonight. I might. And it is why, you know, it's very funny, I was just over at a showing of the movie, the new movie, Coke Brothers Exposed. And we were very interested today. I said, it's not a political event, this is a not-for-profit situation. And so I wouldn't make any statement, I just said, let's test you out. There's a very big crowd there and all that stuff. I said, Scott Walker. She said, you're so polite and respectable. Everybody booed muscle. And then I said, June 5th. And everyone wildly applauded. And so we are in the midst of this incredible moment. And Mary Bell is in the thick of it with everything that she has devoted so much of her life to. Not just the trade union movement, but teaching at stake in Wisconsin. But she comes out to join us because she is indeed a teacher, but she's also like so many Wisconsin teachers. She is a great intellectual and a great thinker and a great advocate on behalf of the Wisconsin idea. And so we are truly blessed to have her here with us with the Madison Institute. And why are we excited to be here for the Madison Institute? Why is this to me the most important of gatherings? Because the Madison Institute is an extension, and I know that Connie and Fred, I'm sure, have told you a bit, and if not Joe Elder, we always kind of do the Quaker takeover here. But the Madison Institute is the embodiment of one of the most magic moments in Wisconsin history. And that is when Midge Miller, and Mary Lou Munce served together in the Wisconsin legislature. And Mary Lou Munce once explained to me, this is how far we are from those days. Mary Lou Munce once explained to me how it worked back in the days when Midge and Mary Lou were really kind of teaching us as a state. We had Ruth Doyle before, we had a couple others before that, but really teaching us as a state what it might mean to have strong women in powerful positions, maybe even as a governor or something. But what they did was absolutely fascinating. Mary Lou told me they would read the Capital Times in the afternoon. And the Capital Times had an article about something that was, you know, minorly troublesome, maybe like there wasn't enough school lunch money for low-income kids in Milwaukee. And Mary Lou would, you know, pick up the noon edition, and she would come over and she'd write a bill in her office. And she'd send it over to the LRB, to Legislative Reference Bureau, to be, you know, kind of analyzed, and the drafters and everybody would take it. And then Midge would schedule a hearing for the next morning. And they would, you know, bring the bill back over, they'd invite everybody to come on in. And, you know, amazingly enough, this is the lie of our modern country. They say, oh, it's so hard to get something organized, it's so hard to have a hearing. They would tell the people about, no, you're going to be here tomorrow morning. We're going to have, there's a story in the paper last night. Come on over. They would have the hearing that day. They would schedule it for the next morning. And by the end of the week, they would have the lunch money for the kids in Milwaukee. Because that's functional government that responds to the people, not to a bunch of lobbyists coming in and telling them what to do. They did not wait for ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, to write the bill. They looked at what was needed and they did it. And Midge Miller, Mary Lou Munson, a few others, but I have to say, Midge, right at the heart of it, she drove this thing like a fine Italian motor car. Right straight through the political process. And I want to tell you, I was with Midge as she was on her deathbed. And we would go over to Capitol Lakes and hang out there. And it was just the best exits you've ever had. Midge would talk every day. She wanted to be briefed on what was going on in the legislature, what was happening, you know, at the national level. She was all excited about this politics. And the interesting thing is, I truly believe that Midge, the only thing that would ever make her sad about her, said, look, in a few years, we're going to have a guy named Scott Walker. She would know him because she had been, he's a career politician. He's been around forever. A few years, we're going to have this Scott Walker guy. He's going to take over. He's going to take away labor rights. And there's going to be a great big mass movement of hundreds of thousands of people across this state that are going to rally at the capitals and the courthouses. And then they are going to, then after they do all that, they are going to organize a recall movement that will gather more than a million, they'll gather a better part of a million signatures against him, 850,000 against his lieutenant governor, 100,000 to take down his cronies in the state senate. You know, I guarantee you this, Midge Miller would have said, okay, I'm not dying. And I will tell you that if you don't believe that, how many of you were at Midge's funeral? Right? If you weren't there, you missed like the best thing going. Because Midge's asked for her funeral. And Midge's asked for a funeral. Of course, she said a couple of things. She wanted to raise some money so we could have a Madison, build up the Madison Institute and really build it out to be something. But her main ask for a funeral was, after everybody does all the mourning in the church and everything, I want there to be a rally on the Capitol steps. And so we went out and we had a great big rally, the better part of 500 people on the Capitol steps with ranting and raving about how fundamentally wrong it is for this country to go abroad fighting illegal and immoral wars, invading other countries, and emptying out our treasuries at home to fund the occupations of distant lands. And then we talked about economic and social justice, and we talked about civil rights, and I think we finished off with a great big rant and rave about the need for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender rights, and it was fabulous. And Midge Miller loved the Madison Institute. She loved what this movement is about, and so I'm so delighted to be with you tonight. I even told Ed Schultz, you know, love doing that, but tonight I got a date. And with all due respect to you folks, it's a date with Midge Miller, but I'm so glad to be here. And I want to talk to you just a little bit about some of the politics, some of the things that are going on, and we'll have some response, we'll do some question and answer. And someone here will ask me, at the end of the evening, oh, by the way, here's the fabulous Lisa Graves. Yeah. Responsible for ALEC Exposed and exposing the American Legislative Exchange Council. And also the head of the Center for Media and Democracy here in Madison. Wonderful. So let's talk about where we're at, what's going on here. I wanna put it in a little bit of perspective because, you know, I get to give so many rant and raving speeches with a fist in the air, but sometimes you don't get to slow down for a bit and talk about the practical reality of what's going on. The practical reality of what's going on right now is that Robert and LaFollette was exactly right. There is no new battle in America. There is no new struggle. Nothing new comes along. And he had a phrase for it. He said, it's the old fight. And he would probably say to you, if you have to ask him what the old fight is, then you haven't been paying attention. Because the old fight, in his view, was between a handful of wealthy and powerful people who had chosen not to expand their wealth and power merely by being good at business. merely by coming up with a new idea, coming up with a new product, but had chosen to expand their wealth and power by entering into the political processes of the nation, taking them over, and creating a politics and then a governance that assured that they would become more wealthy and more powerful. So that on one side. And then on the other side, the great mass of people who, should they allow this process to go forward, would forever be made poorer, less educated, less connected to their democracy itself, so that ultimately, at the end of the day, we would become an oligarchy, perhaps even a monarchy, much like what we fought against in 1776. And this was La Follette's principal preachment. This was his principal message, that there was a constant battle. And the way that he connected with this idea was as a very young kid. La Follette's father died when he was 10 years old. And so he was being raised out in Primrose Township, out in the southwestern part of Dane County, and by a busy mom who had a bunch of other kids. And so the people who raised him were Civil War vets, the disabled vets who had come back from that horrible war. It was the most noble war we ever fought. It was the war in which we the people, ended the sin of our founding, which was to allow any human being to be held in bondage for economic purposes. But the disabled who came home from that war weren't able to work, and so they would sit on the bench in the park in what passed as the center of a crossroads town, and the kids from the town, that was daycare. The kids would come and sit with the veterans and listen to war stories and listen to stories. The veterans who raised Robert M. La Follette taught him a very simple message. It was that the Civil War was not won by Abraham Lincoln. It was not won by the Union Army. It was won by the state of Wisconsin. Period. Nobody else. And if any of you who's had fourth grade history knows that we still teach this. We don't teach it as well as we did, but I actually did not know there were other states until I got into high school. But there was a real genuine faith that there was a lot of kind of weak players, right, that weren't quite as good on the anti-slavery thing, and then there was Wisconsin. And you know, this famous, this wonderful, and we never forgot this thing, we never let go of it. If you go out to Grant County, at Lancaster, you go to the courthouse there, in the corner of the courthouse yard, there's the first statue to the Union dead ever erected. It was erected right after the end of the Civil War. And it is it's so faded now, you gotta go up and look very closely at it, but it's very, very clear. It is two arms raised in clenched fists in the air. And they're muscular African American arms, and they are on each arm are two white hands pulling from each side, and then in the middle is the burst chains, and on that monument out in Lancaster, it says this is to honor those who went to burst the chains of slavery and to make real the promise of American democracy. And so we understood. That what we did in that war was something fundamental. It was not about simply slavery, opposition to slavery. It wasn't about North and South. It was about making real what America could be, making America different than everything we had revolted against. And this is what La Follette was raised in. He was taught that Wisconsin redeemed the nation on a regular basis. You laugh. I mean, you're obviously not rural. You go out to some parts of Wisconsin, and I say that, nobody laughs. They just nod. But it was Wisconsin's job to redeem this country. And so when La Follette was 18 years old, he hitched up the buckboard wagon and headed down or up from Primrose Township to here in Madison, to the University of Wisconsin. It was 1873. And he wanted to prepare himself to go to the great University of Wisconsin, where Joe Elder, I think, was just starting as a young professor. We recently celebrated Joe's 80th birthday, and he still looks like he's about, maybe 61. And so I figure in the Dorian Gray thing. But so he comes down in 1873 to hear the future Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, William Ryan, give a speech about kind of the issues of the day. You sort of like go to a Madison Institute then. And so Ryan comes in, he's speaking to the law school graduating class of 1873. And this is just 8 years after the end of the Civil War. And he says, you know, so maybe he'd talk about the Great Civil War, what we'd accomplished. That's last year's business. He says, there is looming up a threat greater than any threat that this young nation has ever faced before. Corporations operating as political units are leaving the field of business and entering into the processes of our elections for the purpose not merely of participating in the way that citizens do, but for the purpose of buying those elections, buying control of our government so that their corporate power will dominate every aspect of our lives. And he said, the question will arise in your day, if not fully in mine, which shall rule, wealth or man? We now add in parentheses, or women. And who shall fill public stations? Patriotic free men and women, or the feudal serfs of corporate capital? That was in 1873. Sounds vaguely familiar. Now, Robert E. LaFalle took that as his biblical charge. That was how he would live his life. He would be on the side of those patriotic free men and women fighting against the feudal serfs of corporate capital. And it is from there that we define the old fight. That is what this struggle has always been about. And it has come full circle in Wisconsin. If we fast forward to the current moment, and I think we have to be honest with ourselves, and if we are bluntly honest with ourselves, we will tell you that nothing began with Scott Walker. Nothing began with Scott Fitzgerald. Nothing began with Jeff Fitzgerald. I mean, if you meet these guys, you're quite clear that nothing could begin. I recently interviewed Scott Walker's primary challenger in the Republican side, Arthur Cole Riggs.
Yeah.
Now, those of you who don't know Arthur, he was on Steve Walters, the dean of Capitol Reporters on the Wisconsin Eye. And Steve Walters said, well, before we get to the issues of your campaign, the thing where, you know, sometimes journalists have to treat somebody very seriously, even though maybe they don't. And so he said, before we get to the details of your campaign, we should get to know you a little bit. Do you work? And he says, and Arthur goes, I'm on leave from my position. And he says, well, and what was your position? He says, I was the pizza and ice cream guy at the Children's Museum. And Steve Walters right there says, very interesting. But he said, well, have you gone to university? He said, yeah, I did go to university for a while, but I decided to take a break to kind of get a better sense of what I wanted to do. And, you know, he's 23, so that's not, some of you who are parents or grandparents have heard of this phenomenon. And so I tried to take a little break and get to know, you know, kind of where I'm at, maybe what I want to study. But it was at that point as I was watching that I realized that Arthur Cole Riggs has the exact same level of educational attainment as Scott Walker. No, they have both gone to college the same amount. And so when we talk about things starting with Scott Walker, they don't start with Scott Walker. Nothing started with Scott Walker. Nothing started with the Fitzgeralds. What happened in Wisconsin in 2010 was a series of trends in this state and nationally that came to a head. And in this state, we committed what is, I think, the ultimate sin. And that is we allowed our state, our precious state, which really has been what, as Louis Brandeis said, the laboratory of democracy, to be flooded with corporate money, to be flooded with political money. And it was not just Republicans that did this. Democrats and Republicans ceded that citizen power for a money politics. And this is not going on, it's been going on for quite a long time. And, you know, we like to fool ourselves and say, well, yeah, Bill Proxmire used to get elected spending, you know, under $1,000. That's true, he did. But the fact is, Bill Proxmire hasn't been in the Senate since 1989. It's been a long time since we've had anybody running for or getting elected to office spending no money, except, I will say, for Doug LaFalle. But I think Doug is about to have a little bit of a rude awakening in his editorial. And so we allowed money in politics to become a fundamental reality. Long before Citizens United, we let a lot of bad stuff happen in this state. And that opened up a lot of doors for real trouble. But the bigger thing that was going on, this is the kind of ugly reality of a national and international politics. Across this country and around the world, we made a choice a long time ago that, and that's you, not us in this room, but as a country, certainly and as a state, we decided that we're going to balance budgets by and large, by squeezing and cutting. That we won't believe anymore in the idea of growth. We won't believe anymore that if you invest in things, you make it better. And we really accepted as a country that the way to grow an economy, the way to make a just and civil society, was to let corporations make a lot of money, because they're the job creators, and to let wealthy people become very, very wealthy, because then something would trickle down for them. And we have lived for the better part of 30 years in this country with Republicans and an awful lot of Democrats saying, well, you know, taxes are bad. Taxes are bad in government, you know, government kind of gets in the way a lot of times. There's a lot of problems with government. And, you know, there's probably nothing more useless than a teacher. My gosh, you know, boy, they ride their yachts across the lake to pick up their checks. And you know, my heavens, you know, the only thing perhaps more useless than a teacher would be somebody who, like, kept your water clean or something like that. Or heaven forbid, the snowplow driver who came at 2 in the morning to clear your road. All these people are useless. Government itself is a great big mess. You would hear Democrats joking about government almost as much as Republicans, and you would hear the whole of our media. I mean, I'm talking across the board in our media, not Fox, not Limbaugh, but CNN, CBS, NBC, ABC, talking about, you know, government waste, all the, just the evils, the problems of government. And there's nothing government can do as well as the private sector. This is a mantra we have. And you know what the interesting thing is? I'll tell you this, I have covered government and politics for a very, very long time. I remain, aside from dealing drugs, I don't think there is anything that the private sector necessarily does better than government. And I also do not believe that taxes are bad. In fact, I think taxes are very, very important. And I think that when I pay my taxes, if they go to get me health care and housing and a decent civil society, then I will be a happier person, because when I study the planet, what I am told is the countries with the highest taxes have two things. Norway, Sweden, Denmark, all the countries with the highest taxes in the world, they've got two things going on. They have the highest level of democracy. You know, just the Economist magazine, when they do democracy index, the countries with the highest level of democracy are invariably the countries with the highest taxes. So they give you the highest democracy. And the other thing they have is the highest happiness. People actually indicate that they are satisfied, they are happy, they believe that their lives are good. And so I think that we've had far too long in this country where we haven't said that government is good, that taxes are good, that a civil society built by a government where we come together and by the taxes that we pay in communally create something that we should want, not something that we should attack on a daily, weekly, and yearly basis. Something fundamentally wrong was going on in our discourse for a very, very long time. And the private sector crashed and burned. They crashed and burned. Mm-hmm. They were so greedy, so irresponsible, so dysfunctional in their approach that they crashed and burned Wall Street. Yeah. They crashed and burned our banks. They crashed and burned most of our economic structure. And then they came and did the thing. They came and did the thing that we never get to do, which is said, I screwed it all up. I wrecked everything. Give me more money than I had before I screwed it up and before I wrecked everything so that I can do it again. And we gave them not $800 million, that's what they talk about with the bailout. I know some members of Congress who I like very much and voted for it. Anybody who didn't vote for Russ Feingold against that bailout was a damn fool, because that was a giveaway of billions, not 800 million. That was a giveaway of billions and billions and $800 billion. But that is a giveaway of billions and billions of dollars to multinational corporations and banks that put that money in the bank and lived off the interest and they have not brought it back in yet. So they got that nice clear walk away. And then, do you know what they said? This is the interesting thing. And smarter people than I noticed it at the time. They said, you know, the ultimate amount of money that was locked up in the Federal Reserve as a result of the bank bailouts was $4 trillion. I'm going to emphasize that, $4 trillion. Now, huge amounts of that went out in loans to banks and to corporations. Do you know that as we were bombing Libya, we were providing resources from our Federal Reserve to Gaddafi's Bank of Libya? Because we were not just bailing out domestic, we were bailing out everybody around the world. And because we had to prop the economy. That was what we were all about. Well, here's the interesting thing. When he took $4 trillion out of the movement of the country, out of the economy of the country, something happens. The country stalls out, right? We locked up capital. We didn't free up capital. We locked up capital in this country. And capital got a great idea. They said, well, we're broke. See, there's no money. Now, well, Paul Ryan, you just voted for this bailout to give away all our money. Now you're saying that we're broke and we don't have any money for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, community services, all these programs. So, well, Paul, I don't think we're broke. I think you just moved the money over to someplace else. Couldn't we just move it back and then we wouldn't be broke? And he said, no, we are broke. And so we have to have austerity. And austerity, you know, austerity is this wonderful term we use all the time in our politics. And we don't just define it enough. Austerity, which is the, you know, we're going to have shared sacrifice. Everybody's going to have to give something up so that we can function. We can make it through this terrible time. But it never really works that way, right? Because austerity, shared sacrifice, that means it's like everybody's going to have to give up $10. The poorest kid and the wealthiest person are going to have to give up $10. But it means a lot less to the wealthiest person than to the poorest kid. I don't know how many of you have seen the posters made here in Wisconsin. They're made over, I think, Frozen State La Frontera in Milwaukee. They got a picture of a beautiful child, and she's looking up at the camera, and she says, Mama, the governor says that the rich man needs my lunch money. And you know, that's what austerity is. It takes your lunch money and gives it to the rich guy, because the rich guy is going to make everything work. Now, in Wisconsin, Scott Walker brought us an austerity agenda. He said that the way we're going to make things work is by breaking up our unions, by giving our communities the tools to break unions. We're going to defund our schools, take $1 billion out of that. We're going to defund our public services. We do all this, and then everything's going to be fine. Then things are going to work, because government's a problem. It's not the good thing. And I think Scott Walker actually believed that he'd get away with that. But there is an alternative to austerity, and that is accountability. And accountability says that that poor child and her lunch money did not break the country. That the country got broken by the bankers who were then just given all that money and they put it over in their accounts at the Federal Reserve. And so an accountability agenda says something very different than an austerity agenda. And now, let me put it simpler here, because I know this gets very complicated. Economics. So let's say we got a cookie jar, right? It's empty in the morning, and your mom comes in, and your mom says, let's bake some cookies. And you say, that's a great idea, Mom. I love cookies. And so you and your mom, you get all the right materials out. Your mom sends you to the store. You get some flour. You get sugar. And you spend the whole morning baking cookies. You bake so many cookies that you have filled that jar to the brim. And your mom says, but you can't have a cookie until after dinner. Now, you've added your value here. You've contributed to this process. You have given of yourself. You have put something in here for later. You're going to defer, like a worker who's deferred their Social Security until retirement, or somebody's paid in for all these work. You're going to defer that until you're a little bit further along, like after dinner. And so you run out and play. You come back at dinner time, and the cookie jar is empty. What? And you're like, what has happened to the cookies, Mom? And your mom goes, well, you know, they're just gone, and so we're going to have shared sacrifice. And everybody's going to have to give up something. You're going to give up. She said, but Mom, I contributed contributed to the making of those cookies. I paid in knowing that when I got to a certain age, 4 hours later, they went there, and I was going to get some back. And your mom says, you know, I'm sorry, that's just not how it is. We just don't have, we're broke. We are cookie broke. And now in our austerity situation, what you say is, that's cool. All right, I just want to go without the cookie. An accountability response says, Mom, didn't my brother come in about a half hour ago? And your mom went, yeah, I think he did. But doesn't my brother really like cookies? And she said, well, I think he does. And he says, does it? You know, but he couldn't eat all the cookies we made. Isn't there a possibility that my brother took the cookies and put them in his room? And your mom said, well, that is possible. And then he said, well, then I don't want a shared sacrifice. I want to go into my brother's room, find the cookies, and put them back in the jar so that everybody gets a cookie and I don't have to sacrifice because somebody else stole our cookies. That's an accountability. And Wisconsinites decided on February 12th that we were going to demand our cookies. We were not going to let Scott Walker tell us that the cookie jar was empty. We were going to say, no, we believe that there are a lot of corporations that have gotten tax breaks, there are a lot of wealthy people that have gotten all these breaks, and it is time for us to get something back. We have a right to ask for a fair and functional state. And that's what we've always had. That state has always operated on a relatively high level of taxation, and a relatively high level, an incredibly high level of education and public services. Mm-hmm. And that's what we want. We would like to be Wisconsinites. We do not want to be Mississippians. And this fundamental choice that played out, and I'm not going to tell you the story of it. You've read the stories and you've lived the stories. But we built a movement in this state. And this movement in this state is not about replacing Scott Walker. It is not about replacing Scott Walker. If it is simply about getting rid of Scott Walker, I'm going to tell you this. Power doesn't look at politics that way. Power didn't go, oh no, we've lost George Bush, what will we do? You know, where will we find someone with that intellect? No, power says, okay, Bush is gone, now we have to find somebody else, right? Why do you think Dick Cheney is still around? You know, I mean, with his new heart. And this is how power looks at politics and everything as a constant, that it's always going to get what it wants. If we look at this uprising, this incredible Wisconsin uprising, we say the only thing we want out of this thing is to get rid of Scott Walker, because we don't like seeing that bald spot every time he turns his head. You know, that is an insufficient politics. That is not a sufficient politics. A sufficient politics says that we would like to replace Scott Walker, and we would like to replace Scott Walker's politics with something fundamentally different. We want to bring back a Wisconsin way of doing things. We want to bring back a series of ideals and principles that are rooted in ethics and integrity in politics. Now I'll tell you something. Gaylord Nelson would have objected to the way that Scott Walker does politics, but so would have Mel Laird. Yes. You know, the truth of the matter is, you cannot find anybody who was an honorable. Joe McCarthy would be offended by Scott Walker. No, I mean, he'd go like, at the very, or perhaps he would just say, why didn't I think of that? But the bottom line is that what we got is a situation now. And the subject of this talk is supposed to be this uprising, where we go from here. Where we go from here is backward, not forward. Backward, not forward. Because we need to go back to all the things that we have so valued about this state, all the things that we have loved about this state. And we need to recognize that we don't have to give them up. There is nothing that has happened that says Wisconsin has to have a politics defined by austerity, which is a lie. We don't have to have a politics defined by big money politics. We don't have to have a politics defined by the ethics of Scott Walker. We do not have to have a politics defined by the notion that our problem is a teacher, not a CEO. And so, as we look at the next few months, we're going to have an election for governor. And it's going to be, I tell you, I am looking forward to May 9th with a great delight. Because we're going to have a nominee. We're going to have a candidate for governor. And I know Mary cares. And I respect that. She's got a candidate in this race, and I respect that. Many of you may have a candidate in this race. I, myself, have Arthur Cole Riggs. And because I can't wait to cast that first vote against Governor Mark. I want to put those candidates aside. Between May 9th and June 5th, we're going to have a great battle in this state. And it is going to be one of the most important battles that we've seen play out politically in the country. I don't just say that. I'm not the one saying that. The Wall Street Journal says that. CNBC, the Business Channel say that. All the right, all the power says what's going to happen here is the second most important election of 2012. And the reason it's the second most important election of 2012 is because for the first time, we have a chance to have an election between austerity and accountability. We have a chance to say that an American governor elected in this country who chose to balance budgets by attacking unions, by attacking workers, by taking away their rights in their workplace and the political life of this country, who chose to cut school funding, who chose to attack public services, who chose to attack immigrants who want to go to our colleges, simply, maybe even born in this country, their parents weren't, or they came to this country, you're going to do all these attacks, all of this attack, it's just that's how you balance a budget. And then on the accountability side, we have folks who say, no. We need public services, we need public education, we need public employees, and we need teachers who are well compensated with good pay, good benefits, and good pensions to go out and provide the services that we have always had in this state and that have made this state great. That simple choice is a definitional choice for all of America. And what we do on June 5th will send an incredible message across this country. We will either say that, austerity's it. That's where we're headed. You live someplace else. Now, it's bad for us, but can you imagine when they bring the full austerity agenda to Alabama? I'm talking about, this is a genuine degeneration of everything in this country. Chris Christie's coming here to campaign on Tuesday with Scott Walker, because that's what this is about. This is about a nationalized campaign. So we're going to send a message out where it's either going to be an austerity message or an accountability message, that when you come and do those things, we turn you out of office. And that's going to be what the country gets out of this. And it's going to be a very big deal. But what we have to do is look at what happens after June 5th. And our job, in my view, it is the Midge Miller responsibility. The Midge Miller responsibility is to be highly engaged on June 6th, June 7th, June 8th, and a month, and a year, and the years after that, to make sure that we never again end up in a political circumstance where we are forced to make the choices that we are making. And that's not going to be easy. We have to be very, very serious about deconstructing the whole of a system that made this possible. There is a money and politics component of that we have to take incredibly seriously. We've got to amend the Constitution of the United States to say that the Citizens United will have to be responsible. But we have to also do everything we can to restore ethics to our government in this state. We have to fully fund our schools. We have to fully fund our public services. We have to use the word tax, not with shame, but with pride. And we have to say that for working people, their taxes are not going to go up. But for the billionaires, for the millionaires, their taxes will go up. And if somebody says, well, that might scare a job creator into leaving this state, then my answer to that is, if your feeling for Wisconsin is so minimal, if your connection to this incredible state is so slim that you would leave because we ask you to pay just a little bit more, if we ask you to pay your fair share of maintaining our great state, then we welcome you to go and find a corner of Mississippi where you want to live, because we want to live in a great state where we come together and create great businesses, great commerce, but also great public services, great public education, and great, great ethical governance. That's what we have to be about over the next years, or many years. And I will tell you this. This state has not let me down one time over the last year and a half. Hundreds of thousands of people went to the streets. Millions of people signed the petitions. we are now going to have an unprecedented American election where two branches of governments could be flipped on the same day, not just the executive branch, but also the most powerful chamber of the legislative branch. Wisconsin is on the march. We are doing something absolutely amazing. And what we must do, and people say, what comes after this uprising, the Wisconsin uprising and beyond, what we must do is simply keep doing what we have been doing. Because what we have been doing is inspiring the entire United States. And last week, I've been in New York City, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and Pennsylvania. Every place I went, people said, well, I would say, what do you want me to talk about? And you know what they all said? Wisconsin. We want you to talk about Wisconsin, because at the end of the day, Wisconsin is, as it has always been, the laboratory of democracy, that bright, shining star up there along the Canadian border that leads the rest of the country to a higher ground. Let us make it so. Thank you so much for having me.